Hello, we're back from our holidays, so welcome back to Big Mouth, the podcast equivalent of that bag of stuff you cart off on EasyJet with the intent of getting through it all before you come home. I'm Andrew Harrison, and joining me as ever, it's Sian Pattenden, the iconic Judith Chalmers to my Chris Kelly. Hello, Sian, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Andrew.
Jolly good. I've been in America for a fortnight. Did I miss anything?
Well, it's a bit of a coincidence. You went to America and Trump came here for
exchange
some of that.
Exchange programme,
yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It didn't go down well. There were a lot of helicopters around.
Well, I did hear that,
of aircraft.
Nobody, if you're listening in London, the metropolitan elite, apparently nobody could get any sleep at all.
There was loads of Chinooks and stuff. It was quite strange, but quite good.
Did you go and protest yourself?
I didn't, because there were two teenage boys who decided to play PlayStation, didn't want to go down to the West End and protest, but I did watch it on the telly.
The road to fascism.
I know.
Anyway,
I've told them that.
As usual, we have two special guests with us today. Making his Big Mouth debut is David Bennen, veteran of Melody Maker and Loaded, who now writes for The Guardian and 1843 magazine and anybody else who will have him. David grew up in Africa and moved to the UK when he was 18, where, as you would, he threw himself into the mother culture, i.e. the Pixies, My Bloody Valentine, Kinnicky and the John Spencer Blues Explosion. Why not? I can't imagine a better education. Welcome to Big Mouth, David. How are you doing?
Great to be here.
Do you miss the rains down in Africa?
I do these days, yes.
Yeah. How did you get your pop music?
With great difficulty. it's one of those things where, you know, the record collection that's in the house, has a big impact on you. But that was quite random because the record collection was mostly stuff that my dad had bought in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
So there was a lot of... he was very big on the folk revival and he was very big on singer-songwriters. So there was a lot of Judy Collins and Leonard Cohen and things like that. And just strange random things that turned up in the local record shop, I got a Frank Zappa double album for no reason I can understand, and then Deliverance came when we started getting videos of British television about a week after that it had been broadcast. So I used to start watching Top of the Pops on delay, effectively.
Well, you got videos in the sense that people were sending you VHSs?
Yes. Video shops started importing. Basically, the video shops were run by people who had relatives in the UK, and the relatives would just tape a load of stuff off British telly, send it out to Nairobi. We would rent it. So I'd be sitting there watching Top of the Pops a week or a fortnight after it had been on. Which was, it was an education.
On Nairobi Netflix.
Yeah, exactly.
If any of those tapes still exist, it'll be the only way you can still see Jimmy Savile.
Yeah.
Won't it? In your crate somewhere.
Should you wish to do that?
Amongst your glory moments on The Melody Maker was when The Orb met Pink Floyd. Mm. So that must have been a talkative afternoon, getting Alex Paterson and David Gilmour going.
Yeah.
How did you get them going?
It wasn't difficult to get them chatting to each other because they recognize the reason they were willing to do it in the first place was because of their admiration for each other.
So Gilmour actually likes The Orb as well. I mean, you can imagine clearly Alex Paterson is enthralled.
Yes,
by The Orb. Well, Gilmour,
I think he was sincerely flattered by The Orb, with good reason. He was less taken with me. he was a bit grumpy, but then I don't blame him because I have been quite rude about Pink Floyd at times. I have a love-hate relationship with Pink Floyd. The stuff that I love by them I really love, and the stuff that I don't like I'm very rude about indeed. So I don't blame him for being a little prickly, perhaps.
You live in Brighton. Does he still scowl at you when he's walking his dog on the beach?
No, I haven't spotted him lately, although there was an amusing thing that happened a while back when Zoella, the blogger, you probably remember this, posted a picture of, I saw this old man on the beach with a dog, and it was David Gilmour, the only person in Brighton more famous than her, and she had no idea who it was.
Yes, it was already Bless, wasn't it? Yeah. Yes. Also with us this week, we have a returning favourite. Anthony Teasdale was born and raised on Merseyside in my postcode, and he fell into a life of cataloguing the football casual, DJing in the Balearic style, and writing about fancy shoes and sportswear. These days, he edits the men's magazine Umbrella, as well as doing all sorts of, quotes, corporate stuff. He is a self-confessed pretentious London phony. Welcome back, Tony T. There's no point moving to London if you're not going to be a pretentious London phony, is there? That's why we're all here.
If I met myself, I'd despise myself. I'm a terrible person.
And Deborah well turned out terrible person.
Thank you very much indeed.
Yes. As our football culture correspondent, what's your take on what the World Cup means for the culture?
To me, highlight was the Japan shirt.
The Japan shirt? Yeah.
I mean, it's a symphony. It's a symphony in texture, incredible badges, embroidery, the fit. For me, that was the highlight.
Yeah.
Croatia, pretty good. I thought the Nigeria one was, the Nigerian one was like your star man who comes on 10 minutes before the end. You know, it was the David Fairclough, the Nigeria shirt. But for me, yeah, it was an it was a fantastic World Cup of kits. I thought, even I, being a Liverpoolian, started supporting England, which is, you know,
which
most
is a push,
rare,
isn't it?
Which
yeah.
is a most rare for a Scouser to do that.
Also, worst player, Jordan Henderson, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, there were no secrets there if you were a Liverpool fan. I mean, I like him because he plays for Liverpool, but yes. It was difficult.
It was close enough. Dejan Lovren will never get closer to another World Cup, so that was quite heartwarming.
Well, I think, you know, Lovren became extremely vocal after the England game, and fair enough, you know, but I don't think he's quite as good as he thinks he is. But I mean, but he was still better than England on that night. But yes, an incredibly successful and heartwarming tournament. And I'm now getting that thing where I just feel really sad it's over.
Getting football withdrawal. One thing I thought was, like, you've got what a lovely, peaceful, friendly tournament that was, which you can have if you run it in a police state where you get battered if you look sideways at the police. But then it also made me think, isn't it great that football hooliganism has gone? Unfortunately, it's gone into violent street right wing, far right, you know. So I sort of wish we should have football hooligans back again, where we knew where they were and keep them all in one place.
We did have Pitch Invasion, though. Pussy Riot.
Pussy Riot,
are in jail still, I believe, at the time of broadcast. So there's that. It's morphed into something else now.
Sorry, Anne, do you know about this organised football hooliganism thing they do in Eastern Europe, where they all meet in a forest and take their tops off?
What, like the sealed knot or something?
Reenacting Luton Town and Millwall at Kenilworth Road. This is absolutely thing. So what happened is they have these, like, it's a very male thing to sort of, like, codify stuff. And all these chaps get together from, like, various hooligan firms. And they have a big scrap with their tops off. Have a row. There are rules. So if you fall on the floor, you're not allowed to get, a boot in the head. And then the victorious team will, like, head off to some sort of, like, campsite and cheer each other on. It's all over YouTube.
I find it frightening, and I don't think it'll catch on here. Sean, what's on the show this week?
Well, I'm hoping a lot of men in forests with their tops off does catch on here, for obvious reasons. Anyway, there's a whole lot of stuff today you'll be glad to hear. Sacha Baron Cohen's Who is America? Is it any good? What is it saying about our world today now, man? TM. And is there anyone left in politics who can't spot Borat in a different wig? Plus, they've only gone and turned Peter Weir's classic movie of Australian hauntology, Picnic at Hanging Rock, into a series. Does this tale of vanishing schoolgirls and the power of the sexual unconscious really need a 12-inch extended version? And is it any cop? Plus, the new album from Queertronica artiste Lotic, and more choices of summer tunes and books from our guests, and this week me as well. Yay! All after this important message from Andrew.
Two things you can do to make your summer yet more splendid. Number one, back Big Mouth on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. To cover our studio costs, we're asking listeners to contribute the equivalent of a pint of beer at shocking London prices. That's just £5 a month, or the price of a packet of very posh crisps per show. Volunteer this modest amount, and once we reach our target of £600 a month, we will start recording extra bits each week for our Patreon backers. Go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more, and the link is at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page as well. And two, treat yourself to a listen to a new podcast that we started producing for, of all people, Nick Clegg, the former Deputy Prime Minister. It's called Anger Management. It's all about the battle between rage and reason in modern politics. And the current episode is a really good one. It features former Vice President Joe Biden talking about the genuine tragedies that have hit him in his life and how he didn't let anger consume him. Biden was amazing. I've never met anybody as charismatic. It was just superhuman. So go and search for Anger Management with Nick Clegg on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Right, let's get started with Who is America on Channel 4. Sacha Baron Cohen's return to gotcha comedy, in which he entraps sundry American political figures from Sarah Palin to Bernie Sanders into a series of embarrassing interviews. Palin called the show evil, exploitative and sick after claiming that Baron Cohen... That's obviously not sick in a good way, teens. Yeah. Baron Cohen mocked wounded veterans, which he didn't, but... Well, what are facts anymore? Can the artist, otherwise known as Borat and Ali G, reprise his shtick in less forgiving, more divided times? We'll find out after this taster.
Sheket Zahir, my name, Colonel Iran Morad. I am the terrorist terminator.
In America, there is big problem of shootings in schools. The NRA want to arm the teachers. This is crazy. They should be arming the children.
To get deadly weapons into the hands of America's school children, I needed the help of gun rights hero Philip Van Cleef.
In America, there have been a lot of shootings in the school and in the university. What do the liberals say is the reason for this and the solution?
Well, they blame it on guns. Yeah, it's crazy because
they blame it on the guns?
Yes.
Sugar.
Yes.
It's not sugar.
It is.
We start a program in Israel for kindergartens.
Okay.
We train them from the age 16 down to the age 3.
Yeah, well, I think it would be a good idea. We've been pushing something along this line for years, but really haven't gotten any traction with it. We were thinking 7th or 8th grade. You're talking much younger than that.
My son was in the very first program. May he rest in peace. He died doing what I love.
A bit of Who is America, starring Sacha Baron Cohen, which started this week on Channel 4. David Benin, what did you think of this?
I was not taken with it. Mm. And the main reason I wasn't was because the person he seemed to get with his gotchas more than anything were his own characters.
Yeah.
I thought the one bit that worked, I watched the most recent episode, I thought the one bit that worked was with the gun nuts. And
yes.
That worked because for the premise to work, the people you're trying to get have to be as crazy or crazier than your character.
Mm.
And in the case of the gun nuts, they patently were. With Bernie Sanders and the art lady and the Trump supporting couple, what I saw at least, were some actually quite personable people looking at a lunatic doing weird stuff and trying to be polite about it for the most part, and that doesn't work at all. I mean, the Trump couple in particular were actually very pleasant towards him and were trying to understand where his character was coming from.
Yeah.
So all that did was show up the absurdity of the invented character rather than the supposed absurdity of the real people.
Yeah, I mean, there's this insane bit where he goes to dinner with a solid Trump-supporting couple and comes out with, the character he's playing at the time is a full-on, totally woke, fully intersectional, ticking all the boxes of contemporary sort of progressive thought. And just pushes it further and further out by describing his daughter menstruating on the American flag and his wife having sex with a dolphin.
Yeah.
And one of these, the wife in the couple the husband's getting slightly annoyed about it. And the wife says, honey, don't judge. Don't rush to judgment.
Mm. Yes.
And you're like, well, that's actually a really nice thing for anybody to say. So the only person who's coming out of that segment as looking foolish is Sacha Baron Cohen himself.
That's what I thought. And it certainly didn't make me think badly of Trump supporters as a cohort, although I'm sure that in other ways there would have been many ways to get me to do so. But in a way it almost functioned as an advert for them, which is completely, I suppose, against what the idea was in the first place.
Yeah. Anthony Tuesdale, what did you make of the show?
Well, I always found these programs really cringy, and if I had a sofa, I'd watch behind from it. because I don't really like this sort of stuff, but I did watch it. And at times it did provide me with the odd belly laugh. And I thought the Israeli agent, I thought he had quite a good accent.
Yeah.
And I thought the stuff he did with the kids and
he's trying to promote this idea that, like, children under the age of 5 should be armed.
Yeah. And he calls them kindergartens.
There was these fake toys. It was an Uzi corn, which was a unicorn with an Uzi underneath. I thought that was quite amusing. But it's not something we haven't seen before.
Yeah. And it was a long old haul to that, wasn't it? Because the gun nut bit that we had a little excerpt earlier, it appears at the end of the show after we've seen him doing a routine in an art gallery where he pretends to be a prisoner. He does paintings in his own poo.
Yeah.
Like, how amazingly edgy and imaginative that is. It's a long old haul before you get to me, it was the substance of maybe a 3 or 4 minute bit on The Daily Show, if you're lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. And the stuff where he got the art lady to cut some of her pubic hair off.
Yeah.
I did start thinking this is a bit yuck, and she sort of like went with it.
She came across as really well, and I think that wasn't the point. He's trying to make fun of everybody, and then it backfires because she's realising it's some sort of joke. She's in on it in some way. She's clocked, so she just goes along with it. So I thought she was amazing, and then his character weakens because of that.
Yeah.
I didn't know what the point of that was.
What did you think of the whole thing?
I didn't really know what the point of it. I think Chris Morris could have done it a billion times better and something weirder. What I found quite interesting is, so if you did go to the truthbree.com, which one of the characters is from.
He's a kind of conspiracy theorist, isn't he? Yeah.
So truthbree.com exists, so you can go and look at it. And what they've done is simply cut and paste articles from the last 10 years just from off the internet and put it in one. It's all, is rock and roll part of the CIA? And it's all about Hillary Clinton being the devil and that sort of thing. And he's actually just taken it from other sources, and together the website is more interesting than that section of the programme. And what he could do maybe with websites and Facebook and the idea of fake news and proliferation is something far more interesting doing on the website, far more now than just putting out a 27-minute show and going, hey, aren't I funny?
My main problem with it was, apart from the fact that I just didn't laugh, was that it just seemed so dated. It just seemed, you know, this is a form of comedy that made a lot of sense in about 2000. But now that we're surrounded by characters who are as absurd, if not worse, than the ones he's putting out there, you can totally understand why the marks, why the people who are supposedly going to be conned by this would just go, yeah, this is just another figure from the kind of, you know, the bestiary that is modern celebrity and politics. It seemed like doing a kind of 1970s Mike Yarwood impersonation show in the era of Spit and Image.
I need Ian Lee back.
Oh, yes, of course.
Because wasn't he the host of the 11 o'clock show back in the day when Ali G first appeared?
Yeah. Yeah,
and Ricky Gervais on the same show as well, if I remember.
See, I thought Ali G was fantastic because, the gag there is old people don't understand youth culture, which is true. But this was kind of, who's expected to understand an Israeli kind of Krav Maga, gun nut security fiend? Yeah. You know, it's the caricature and the reality. You know, most of us don't have any experience of those people.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's a bit of character comedy. Like Tony, I thought that character worked. He made me chuckle, and that bit made me chuckle. But again, that was because the people he was targeting showed that they merited that kind of targeting. Whereas, if I put it this way, if I hadn't been watching for this show, I'd have switched off long before I had got to that bit.
Yeah, it did seem like.
I would say a 13-year-old really likes the gun gags and thought that bit was excellent, because I showed my son and he just thought that was brilliant. So I think maybe that's the audience, though. If it is teens, well, there's nothing wrong with that, but I feel like I have seen it a lot.
It's quite funny getting a sort of American lawmaker to talk about the hormone Blink-182 kind of thing.
Yes, but, and Cardi B.
The Cardi B system. I don't think I'm going to be going back and watching it, though. Oh, we're all just too old for it, aren't we?
We're too old for us, or maybe.
I last laughed in about 1996.
What was it at? That's what I want to know.
An indie disco.
All right, moving on. All summer, we've been asking our guests to suggest tunes and books that you can take away to that chalet in Calais or that Dacca in Dornish. Luckily, it's been quite a nice summer, so the whole thing has made a lot more sense than telling you to listen to summer music in the pouring rain. We're going to scatter our guest choices throughout the show, and we're going to start with David Bennans. So here we go. Okay, that was David Bennan's recommendations of summer stuff. We heard Camino del Sol by Antenna from his classic summer album Camino del Sol by Antenna, followed by Re-Up from Rationale by Rationale, a lot of eponymous going down today, and a choice of his choice of a new summer album, and David's ultimate summer tune, Genius of Love by Tom Tom Club. All right, David, who are Antenna and what are they all about?
Antenna were a group who were on Factory in the early 80s, but they weren't on the main Factory label. They were on Factory Benelux, which was their kind of European testing label.
Yes.
Which is, and I can see Tony's...
Tony's delighted.
Tony's sort of grimacing there. Yes. Which is, I think this is so far up his feet, it's living in his house.
Yes.
And, and they were led by a woman called Isabel Pawaga, I think is how you pronounce it, who changed her stage name to Isabel Antenna after the band had been in existence. Mm-hmm. And she's gone on to have a very creditable solo career. She's very popular in Japan in particular. She's literally big in Japan.
Literally big in Japan, yes.
And Camino del Sol was their first major, as in substantial release. I think it was a mini LP. About five songs on it, and it's this wonderful sound that they called electro samba, which is it's really bossa nova but done electronically. So it has that delicate languor that bossa nova and samba have got.
Yeah.
That very sort of gentle sound like waves lapping on the beach, but it also has a very mysterious quality. It's very spooky because of the electronic sound of it. So it's kind of like a haunted summer listening to
it. Oh, wow. Did you discover this in Nairobi?
No, this is something I discovered much later when I sort of... my musical education did come late, not surprisingly, when I came to England and I started learning all about, indie and new wave and post-punk and stuff like that. So I only really discovered it when a very good label called Numero, released a collection of all of Antenna's group recordings, also called Camino del Sol, which was that mini LP plus a few other tracks with it. And I was absolutely fascinated by it. I remain so. It's the atmosphere of it is extraordinary.
It's like Bebel Gilberto 30 years early.
Yeah, it's
more lo-fi.
Yes, and funny you should mention it. They were Antenna were a big influence on Thievery Corporation,
yeah.
Who of course went on to work with Bebel Gilberto. And so, you know, they're a band of unacknowledged influence, not surprisingly.
Mm. And your new summer album is Rationale by Rationale. Who is Rationale? And what's the rationale for you liking Rationale?
Again, this is one of those records that it feels like a summer record to me. But when we talk about summer records, we're usually thinking of sort of quite light, upbeat, dancey things.
We haven't heard Sean's yet. We'll get to that later.
I mean, that's usually what people seem to understand by a summer record, you know, the Beach Boys All Summer Long, which, by the way, is actually a very sad record if you stop and listen to it, but that's by the by. And to me, a lot of the greatest summer records have that sadness in them. They have an undercurrent of melancholy. We're all aware, I think, of how temporary summer is. We find it very difficult to be fully in the moment, I think, when it's summer, because we're always aware it's going to end. We're always aware that the days will shorten and the temperature will drop. And boy, I'm really cheering everybody up here, aren't I?
You're listening to Bring Down FM. Yeah. Anyway, come on, we've still got August and better July.
Yeah, then we've got autumn. Come on. Yeah. Anyway, let's.
But I do think that melancholy is also part of what's lovely about summer. I think that that slightly sweet, sad undercurrent is part of what's nice about
You're basically describing Seasons in the Sun now, aren't you?
Basically. Basically. Yeah.
So who is Rationale?
Rationale, I think he was born in Zimbabwe. I think he's from Harare, and I think he grew up in London. And he had an earlier stab at a career under the name of Tinashe, not to be confused with the current female singer called Tinashe.
Okay.
And he clearly had something, but I'm not sure that even he knew quite what. And his singing career didn't take off, and he became a songwriter for other people, notably Rag & Bone Man, who's not one of my great favourites. I think Rag & Bone Man is very talented and very slick, but I find his stuff quite hollow. Mm. And to me, Rationale, when I heard it was like, this is what Rag & Bone Man should sound like to me.
Yeah.
If it actually had what I feel is soul, this is what it would sound like.
Mm.
So you can hear the same qualities in his songwriting, which I think is very good. I think I think he's a very precise writer. He writes very simple, precise lyrics, which is not an easy thing to do, especially in a very pop idiom. And it sounds very much like a breakup album. There's a lot of songs which sound like the long-term relationship coming apart. But the sound of it is very in line with neo-soul, which is something that I'm really enjoying at the moment, bands like Jungle. So it's got this deep, quite sad, but also very light sound.
Yeah. And your Ultimate Summer Tune is pretty kind of undeniable.
Yes,
Genius of Love. Everybody loves that one, don't they? Mariah Carey loves that one.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, I've often thought that Genius of Love should actually be used as a clinical test of whether somebody is not clinically dead.
Yes.
Basically, just play it at them, and if they don't even like twitch, they're gone. That's it.
Yeah. And we've also been asking our guests for their summer books, things to take on the beach, and you suggested Lyndon B. Johnson, Portrait of a President by Robert Dalek.
Yeah.
Not actually a Dalek.
Yeah. No, it's... I mean, again, it might not be the most obvious summer choice, but it'll certainly keep you occupied on the beach all the time. I think it's a fascinating piece of biography about what, probably to me, the most fascinating political figure of the 20th century.
Yeah,
I think Johnson is he is a figure of such contradictions, and what I've learned, I think, from reading Dalek's biography. It was a sense I had about him before, but once you get into the details, you really see it, which is that there's a saying by Carl Jung, which has been a lot on my mind lately with regard to politics. Carl Jung is not my favourite person, but I think this saying is bang on, which is, you are what you do, not what you say you will do. Mm-hmm. And Johnson is a man who was very much what he did and not what he said he would do. If you looked at him as a figure, you would have thought he was the most backward, redneck Texan bigot. And he certainly played to that gallery. And yet he was a man who went on to seek and achieve power and use it in remarkable ways, remarkably progressive ways. Mm. And if you look at his so-called Great Society, if you look at the legislation he brought in to improve the lives of poor people and people of colour, I'm not sure any political figure in American history has done more, not even Lincoln.
Well, I'm a big fan of the heavy history book on the beach, the mega serious thing, so yeah. I approve of that. We're going to have Tony and Sean's choices later on in the show, but first, some dance music. Lotik, a.k.a. Jakarian Morgan, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is a Houston-born, Berlin-based producer with a background in marching band music and club noise. Being of highly individual sexual orientation, Lotik prefers the pronoun they, and they released their new album, Power, last week. It's the sound of Berlin queerdom. They once did an EP called Heterocetera, which I think is excellent, and Lotik ended up doing a Bjork remix on the very day they got evicted from their dingy flat, swings and roundabouts, eh? So what's it like? Here's one track. This is Lotik with Heart featuring Moro. Lotik with Heart from Power, which is out now. Anthony Teasdale, you DJ, you play records one after the other, on, you know, often using two hands at the same time. What did you make of this?
I thought it was like going to a very trendy factory or industrial estate.
Oh, those trendy industrial estates you're always hanging around.
And it had the sound, it sounded quite a lot like the cash register at Tesco put in rhythmatic form.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying Radiophonic Workshop here?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting and it was difficult, and I could say that I absolutely loved it and I gave it a really good listen because I'm quite open to a weird sound, but I do like more melody. And I thought it was very akin to the Sabres of Paradise, if you remember those from back in the day.
Yeah.
Lots of sounds that were quite metallic and sharp and using sort of machines in a rhythmic way to create a rhythm and then melodies around that. Quite Aphex Twin, but more on the weird side of Aphex Twin. So as a self-confessed quilt, as they say, and I'm a lover of melody. I found some of this quite difficult, and it isn't an easy listen, but it is worth listening to.
So I found it quite a difficult listen that was easy to hear, if you see what I mean. You know, there's lots of strange things going on, but they slide past very, very easily. You know, it's kind of, the textures are nice. It's not abrasive. It's not really the way the Aphex Twin records became as time went on. David, what did you think?
It reminded me of the last time I went for an MRI.
In a good way?
Yes, actually. I mean, you know, if you've been, don't know if you've been for one, but they immerse you in this machine. They slide you into a capsule. And they gave me headphones and a little microphone to let them know if I was getting claustrophobic and needed to come out. And then all the magnets start whirring. And the hardest part for me was keeping still. Far from being claustrophobic, I was getting flashbacks to the 90s. And when they took me out after 20 minutes, I was thinking, like, no, I want to hear side two. And it was a bit like that. It was, lots of whirring and clattering and clunking. And unlike Tony, I'm a big fan of melody. And it's not something that I would put on for pleasure ordinarily, but I did find it intriguing.
Yeah, it's kind of funky without being especially danceable.
Yeah.
It's kind of, there's lots of kinks and twists on the way without it being report to the dance floor stuff. There's a lot of, from the kind of the advanced descriptions about the sort of, very forthright sexual politics of the thing, I was expecting it to be a lot more old-fashioned jacking, and it's not. It's kind of, this is art. This is exactly the kind of person who's going to end up working with Björk, isn't it? Yeah.
I thought that Beyoncé is getting on the phone right away, actually. Yeah. I thought, yeah, you're going to nick half of that or get... Lotic in. I also thought, so my notes say, Tony thinks it sounds like an industrial estate. I think it sounds like a boutique hotel. You know, in the way that they're very designed, but they're slightly frightening. So you see a Philippe Starck doorknob or something, you go, ooh, actually, I'm not sure. And yet some of it is just meant to make you feel, you know, you're in a nice environment. There's something about, it's architectural music.
Yeah.
And in that, it is easy and difficult at the same time. It's really interesting record. Mm. And again, I thought, well, maybe I wouldn't have put this on normally, but actually in the background it might be quite nice. It's rhythmic. I also think there's loads of melody in there.
Yeah.
I would say there's loads of harmonies. There's a very high singing in the background. You can't hear the lyrics that much. It's really rhythmic. It sort of does everything all at once. And maybe you get, oh, that's a bit too much for me. But, yeah, I admired it, I think, a lot. And all the mainstream artists are going to go, yes, please, can I have some of that?
I think Beyoncé co-opting it could be the best thing that could happen, actually. I think that will be brilliant. I love
thought Love and Light would really go with... She could do something with that.
Yeah.
I mean, they could work together and it would be just fantastic.
As a producer with maybe pop hooks on top.
Well, the vocals,
but not to discredit his work here, obviously.
Well, the vocals are actually kind of fairly few and far between, aren't
they? Yeah, they were.
But there's a great lyric about being, sexually indeterminate, threatening presence that nobody knows how to look at in the right way, and sort of, you know, cutting your way through the world on your own terms. Just the fact that Lotic is it's a gay African-American living in Berlin, so like straddling lots of different cultures here, does that shape the way we listen to it, or did you just stick it on with that?
I did think about that, because I thought, if I didn't know those things about Lotic, would I have inferred them from listening to this record? And the answer is very much no. So that context probably did change the way I listened to it. Had I just heard it without any knowledge of the artist behind it, I think I would have thought that it was intriguing is the word I use, and I'll stick with it, abstract electronic record that I liked but wasn't going to rush back to. It's those undercurrents of meaning definitely come from the context, from the knowledge of knowing who's behind it.
I think I was a bit disappointed it was less dancey, because when I read that it had those elements in, I was hoping, great, it's going to be
modern mega drug ball.
It was going to be an updated version of Sylvester, but sadly it wasn't. And it was, to me, very much like, I don't know, is it a bit Buds of Canada,
plaid,
Aphex, plaid, all alone. That sort of thing.
Which I love. In a way, I sort of think, you know, it's kind of putting people in boxes to expect that, you know, like the gay guy's going to do the dancing stuff, and if it's going to be art, if it's going to be plinky plunky art stuff, it's got to be a skinny white bloke living in a bedroom in Sutton Coalfield is the kind of, that's where that stuff comes from. I like the idea that we could have a modern Sylvester who makes Delia Derbyshire music. I think it's a good thing. I thought it had loads of character just beyond, you know, it's, I think a lot of kind of abstract electronica kind of flatters to deceive. It's not that difficult to do a load of washes of sound.
Yeah, a lot of people do it by the yard, that's true. And I did not think this was a record made by the yard, absolutely. I thought this was a record in which I sensed and heard a great deal of care.
Apparently the word Lotik means living in the water.
Living in moving water.
Living in moving water.
You inhabit it. You are the force that stays where it is, and the water rushes past you, which is rather lovely, isn't it?
Oh, right. Because there are two... the ancient Greeks had two sort of strong opposing philosophical ideas, one being that you can never step in the same river twice, and the other being that you were always in the river and the river was flowing past you. Yeah. So Lotik clearly goes for the latter.
You don't get this on Round Table on Radio 1 on a Friday afternoon, you know, or when they used to do that.
You might get this. I'm going to say, can we have a remix album? I'm going to be pop here and say, come on, get a remix album. And then we can dance to it and then listen to it architecturally when we want to at the same time.
Architectural listening. Yes. That's what we need.
OK, let's get a move on and have more summer tunes. What will our guest, Tony Teasdale, choose for his classic summer album, his brand new summer album, and his ultimate summer tune, and Your Beach Read? Here we go.
What is love?
The summer sounds inside Anthony Teasdale's brain. That was Delight with What Is Love from World Cleek, his choice of classic summer album. Then Orca by house duo Bicep from their debut album, which critics would argue is both eponymous and self-titled. Then it's on with the chevignon jackets and stripy long-sleeve t-shirts for the ultimate summer tune, Saint Etienne with Only Love Can Break Your Heart. Back to 1990, it's going to be a terrace casual summer. So this is all very of the moment, isn't it? Was 1990 a good summer, Tony?
Yes, absolutely. I think it was when the influence of acid house and the football scene that I'd been involved in as a kid sort of really came together. And I think you saw that before the World Cup of Italia 90 with the release of the No Alla Valencia t-shirt by Borough, which is, I would say, a design classic.
Have you got eight in your wardrobe?
I've got one now. I couldn't afford one at the time. All I think if you remember, you have that period when, you know, before you were a grown-up, when your mum buys you one t-shirt or like a pair of trainers, and then suddenly you realise you have more wealth than Crassus when you can buy two sets of trainers or two t-shirts. So I was actually given one recently. And it's absolutely everything I stand for. Mm. It's that love of European football culture. It's the love of pretty girls in stripy tops with bobbed hair.
Listeners should be aware that Anthony is actually wearing a stripy top as we record. He's got his Breton fisherman's t-shirt on right now.
I'm living the dream.
Yes.
Is Delight's World Cleek a bit neglected now, do you
Absolutely.
Think? It you was don't neglected. Hear it around
No,
you?
It's a really, really great album. I mean, like a lot of DJs, I tend to pick and choose tracks. But World Cleek, I would insist everyone goes back to it. You know, so it starts with, it's got like Good Beat and Power of Love. And these are very much like Italio house type tracks of the time. Early garage. You hear early garage drum programming on there, which makes me sound a bit like, you know,
massive nerd.
A massive nerd and a mixing engineer. But it is incredibly good fun. It's really well produced stuff. Try Me On is great, Power of Love, and then Groove in the Heart. And I think the thing with Groove in the Heart is that's recorded as an underground New York like funk house record, and it becomes an enormous pop hit. Yeah. And you forget actually how absolutely fab it is. It's really joyful. It's on Spotify.
Also, you can play it at any event, at any time,
yeah,
anywhere.
And everybody's.
And it's an emergency instant yeah. get report to the dance floor job.
They play it in Primark Marble Arch every time I walk
Bang.
In there, but
really?
They only play half of it. So I want to tell them, play the whole thing, but maybe that's a rights issue.
Get a grip, Primark.
Yeah, yeah, Primark, yes.
And the whole album is very European for yeah. a New York record of that time. You could, you know, it was unusual for New York artists to be incorporating that stuff.
I think it was DJ Dimitri. There's been many Dimitris in the world. Yeah. There's the Dimitri from Paris.
This is Dimitri not from Paris.
Yeah. No,
it's
Dimitri
from Russia.
Yeah, he was from. Yeah. And I think you're right. It's got that European element because of him. And then there was a Japanese DJ.
Tolete.
Yeah, and then Lady Miss Kia, who was a fox and a half. And she wore incredibly fab psychedelic clothes. And looking at the video, it looked like Britain because they've all got stripy tops and white jeans. This is again the high point of Western civilization, and I insist that you listen to it.
Okay, tell us about Bicep and why are they so summery.
Bicep are great. It's like when you don't really know what to put on, put Bicep on.
Okay,
because Bicep is like listening to a really good DJ mix. It's full of really funky, easy to listen to house music, and there's like breakbeats in there and nice melodies. And if you've got a deadline. Then this is deadline music. Yeah. It's headphones on. I've got to do some work. Right. And, you know, I mean, I'm a man who loves to dance in the chair, as the people I share in office will tell you. And this is an excellent chair dancing album. So, I think I like it in the same way as I like World Clique, because it's coherent. It fits together as a whole. And without a gap, it's all the same sort of stuff, and no one's reinventing the wheel here. It's just incredibly good fun.
It's a bit like you sort of think if times were different and records still kind of were purchased the way they used to be purchased, it would be like that Left Field album,
yes,
which is a load of people's way into a kind of music that they would have found a bit difficult to gain entry to.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, it would be, if you were out DJing and you didn't know what to play, you could play four or five of this lot and you'd have a full floor. So again, if you were looking for something that's easy to get into, lots of melodies, lots of funky rhythms,
okay,
give it a go on Bicep.
Is there anything left to say about Only Love Can Break Your Heart? Why have you picked that one?
I think personally, it symbolises maybe the culture that I love. But there's other things. It's I remember hearing and reading about this group called Saint Etienne, and I thought that was a really cool name. I liked European football culture. They wore these stripy duffer tops. They wore like football tops from the 70s. I thought these are cool. And at the same time, I'd been hearing this mysterious record with this strange vocal. I thought that's great. And then one day they came together, and actually, it was the same thing. And it reminds me of that brilliant Italian 90s summer. The video, and I would suggest go to YouTube and look at this, is if you are a lover of North London, which what I am, is that it's a great picture of North London in 1990. It's got the Hampstead Lido on, stuff like that. And the singer in it, interesting, well, all right, not that interesting facts.
Moderately interesting.
One, it's not Sarah Cracknell That's who's singing right. yeah, it, which yeah. is what we all know. Yeah, yeah. It's
Moira Lambert.
Lambert. But she is not in the video either. No. It's the landlady's daughter who is French.
Oh,
that well.
I see.
Mm. So that is that.
How very bricolage.
It's great and it's fun and it makes you feel happy and sad like
but
the best
whole
pop
album
music.
Is massively summery as well, isn't
yeah.
it?
Although
kind of like so it's like about out of focus pianos and tracks like Spring and you know Girl 7 is it? Girl
you know what? Why don't we just all leave here? When the clocks go back, let's move to Mallorca and let's listen to that for 5 months and then come back again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fine, with Brexit, that'll be easy.
Right.
Yeah. You've got two summer books, Fatherland and Pompeii by Robert Harris.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to books, I like real trash.
Right.
And I've got absolutely no taste whatsoever.
Tell us about these
okay,
trashy books.
So,
very quickly.
Both by Robert Harris, they are both what I would term slightly intelligent thrillers. Fatherland is what The Economist called what-if history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's post-war, Germany's won the war, and it's about a hard-bitten, slightly cynical detective finding a body in a Berlin park. And that leads to lots of finding out about things that happened in the war that they didn't know about. So that's, I mean, if you like a thrill, and I do, great. Mm-hmm. Pompeii, this is for fans of ancient history and aquatic engineering. You know, both of you. And again, it's about Vesuvius. And it's about how the Romans got water about. So that's really interesting. And then it's about, obviously, Vesuvius, what happened over a period of time. It's brilliant. They are not difficult books. Mm-hmm. They are really interesting and a great beach read.
But Harris is fantastic at being able to turn, you know, kind of... It's like they're like thrillers with a bit of E.E. Green as well.
Yeah,
it's kind of like you manage to get your historical kind of nourishment while also getting a good, you know, look, plenty of sex and violence along the way.
Absolutely.
Good
fantastic.
Beach stuff.
Fantastic, yes.
Finally, Picnic at Hanging Rock. Peter Weir's classic of Australian cinema was one of the eeriest fixtures on TV in the 1980s. With its intriguing blankness and a refusal to explain itself, this story of a group of schoolgirls who vanish on a trip into the outback on Valentine's Day 1900, perhaps into a world beyond the colonisers' logic, announced a brand new and entirely Australian form of cinema. It was hypnotic and disturbing and possibly a perfect film. So why remake it as a TV miniseries? Which part of this story needs expanding upon? The small screen version of Picnic at Hanging Rock, starring Natalie Dormer from Game of Thrones, has just started on the BBC, and we're going to have a look at it after this taster.
Some of your companions have managed to lose themselves. We've escaped.
Something terrible has happened.
Here it is then, retribution.
They stopped searching.
Shocking. It's been a week.
Where are they?
The girls are gone.
Missing. Presumed dead.
Natalie Dormer and a load of other Sheilas in a picnic in Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Crikey.
Yes, crikey. Hands up, who knew the movie? Who knows the movie? Yes, everybody but Sian. Sian, you'd love it. This is so
I know I would. I think that's why I never watched it, because everyone told me to watch it all the time.
It's amazing. So, Tony T, in comparison, what do you make of this remake extension, 12-inch deluxe edition
reimagining? Version 2.0.
Version 2.0, in comparison to the movie.
Okay, well, I went back to the old movie. Oh. On YouTube.
Homework, yesterday. Like it.
Yeah, you know, this is why I'm on the big books. And part of it, it's quite similar. You know, there are like identical shots, almost exactly the same in parts. But the new version is very much like Marie Antoinette, the Coppola film. Mm. It's like, it's had a steampunk remix, which sounds objectionable. but it's, I still thought it was great. It still was weirdly creepy. I think they're bringing in a bit of a bigger backstory about the teacher.
Yeah.
Quite sure, yeah. And, of course, there is a notorious Me Too moment in there as well, with a pitchfork and an objectionably forward stable lad.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. The extension is coming from... I mean, in the original, it's very much a strange visitation of events occurs in the place you would least expect it to happen. And the... effectively the kind of the world of the unknown, potentially the unconsciousness of Australia itself, impinges into the world of the Europeans and weird stuff happens. In this new version, the teacher, Mrs. Appleyard, has a secret that is not really kind of present in the same way in the movie. And we get to expand upon a lot of the characters, don't we? Personally, I loved it. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. David, what did you reckon?
Well, I didn't want to... The movie is one of the key films of my childhood. I don't know how many times I've seen it, and I absolutely love it. I wanted to be careful about comparing it to the movie because, in fairness to the makers of the TV show, it is technically not a remake of the movie. They're both adaptations of the novel, which predates the movie by years.
And lots of people believe that this is a true story. It isn't, is it? Yeah. It is a novel.
Yes, but that's because John Lindsay, who wrote the novel, was deliberately opaque about whether it was truth or fiction she was writing. She encouraged the misunderstanding that it was based on a true story, something that the Coen brothers would later go on to do with Fargo, of course. The first words you see in Fargo are, "This is a true story." But, of course, it's not. It's fiction. You're watching a film. and Joan Lindsay did pull the same trick almost 30 years before with her novel. So I don't want to be overprotective of movies I love, because that way you might sort of end up like, you know, the sort of like those Ghostbusters idiots moment.
So they've remade Picnic at Hanging Rock with boys.
So I tried not to think of it simply as a remake of the film, but as an adaptation of the novel. So tried to see it as a piece of telling in its own right. And of course, one episode in of a 6-part series, it's hard to really get the measure. I did find it. I found the exposition kind of clunky, but then first episodes do tend to do that. But the thing about both the book and the film is that the key element in them, and it was identified in the book by its author and by the editor, who was hugely important in the mystery element of the book. It was the editor who told Joan, I think Sandra Rhodes was her name, told Joan Lindsay to leave off the last chapter, which explained the mystery. So that open-ended mystery in the book and the film is thanks to her. But they both identified the atmosphere of the Australian outback as the key element in it, which I think is missing from the TV show. The TV show is more of a blood and thunder Victorian melodrama, and it reminds me a bit of actually of Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. It's like a graphic novel almost, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Mrs. Appleyard's ex-husband appears in a dream in this one as well, and I thought he looked like Alan Moore. He comes to haunt you.
I fled to Australia to get away from Alan Moore.
Yes, and here he is.
I was quite surprised. I thought he'd be more handsome, because like she's quite a catch.
She's a big catch, It's interesting, because the atmosphere of Australia is absolutely the star of the original movie. It's like you've stepped into the other world. You're almost in the dreaming. What I find interesting about this is it's directed by, or at least some of the episodes are directed by the woman who directed Legion, my current favourite Marvel show, which is, you know, like The Prisoner meets an XTC album meets, you know, some kind of chocolate watch band, fantasy of 60s Britain. And it had that same obliqueness, that same kind of, you know, willful kind of flipping of the camera upside down and the creation of uncertainty of whether what you're seeing is really happening or if it's inside the minds of the characters.
Yeah.
I found that really intriguing. But it's busier. It's not as empty and open and arid as the first movie.
Yeah, and it
could have been set in Hampstead, though, couldn't it? Yes. Yeah. I mean, quite frankly,
exactly,
you don't
yes.
get much of that
Picnic
style.
At Hampstead,
Hampstead Lido. Yeah.
And I thought of it as a bit. It was a bit Mean Girls like Hanging Rock.
Got to be said though, everyone looks fantastic, don't they? Yeah. The costumes are so beautiful, and Dormer is this tyrannical,
but
this martinet. She's amazing.
Natalie Dormer is a little bit young for the role, and that's why I was thinking she's a woman who's lived, and yet she looks about 25, and I think she's only just under 30, isn't she?
I think she's got a young old face.
And I thought the schoolgirls all look like they're 35. I always have a bit of a problem with that, the casting. I mean, they've really got to be 14, 15 year olds.
Grease at Hanging Rock.
It's about female sexuality, and I think Australia is really, really good at, in films and TV, exploring that top of the lake, heavenly creatures. There's even Animal Kingdom has a matriarch, and the idea there's a matriarch and the bonds and the enemies that you also make as a schoolgirl and between you, the female element. I want to see that much, much more, so that we get an idea of that strangeness. Have weird things like in Carol Morley's The Falling, where, you know, there seems to be a scourge of people just losing consciousness.
Yeah.
And usually within things like boarding schools, everyone gets the period at the same time. Mm. There's sort of things that if it gets all kind of gristly and weird like that, I quite like that.
Well, spoiler, as luck would have it, they had the whole series on the plane, so I'm a couple of episodes
goodness.
Ahead.
Oh, I see.
And I can say, Virgin Atlantic, well done, maybe we'll get some free flights. But I can tell you that it does go in to explore those things in quite an intriguing
good.
Way. It also, it also explores the kind of, I forget his name, but the male witness, the young kind of fallen son of the local gentry and his sort of struggles with his homosexuality and so forth. That's explored a fair bit more. So, in sacrificing what David was describing, that kind of great terrifying aridity and openness and kind of you've stepped into a parallel world that the first movie adaptation really majored on, it brings in a new thing, which is every one of these characters has their own private madness.
Is it an Aussie noir?
Is it Aussie noir?
Yeah.
It could well be Aussie noir. Mm. It's too colourful to be noir, isn't it? It's kind of it's like Aussie gothic.
Yes.
It's
Aussie steampunk.
Outback gothic. Also, I just like the fact that this version sort of tacks a little bit more towards the horrendous Victorian boarding school melodrama tradition, which we have neglected. Why do we get Peaky Blinders when we can't have good old Victorian girls boarding school misery fest.
But I bet I thought of Peaky Blinders watching this and thought, I bet they're kicking themselves they can't use any PJ Harvey, because that would be amazing on the soundtrack.
Yeah, well, they do. There's elements of sort of...
Yeah, there's modern music in it, which is quite interesting.
It's got some great lines in it, though, sort of when Mrs. Appleyard is telling one of the girls who's getting her having her period for the very first time, she says, "Maladies flourish in the dark." You know, it's just like, it's like screaming to be sampled by somebody.
Yeah. I thought what was interesting was that this was an Australia that was still almost like England.
Yeah,
and you know, as you said, it could have been Hampstead. The whole point is that, well, you know, we're going to carry on with our traditions here, and here's some nice chaps in straw boater hats. Mm. I mean, they look great, and here's some nice girls from the school. And it's just like England. And then suddenly, actually, there's this deeper history here.
Yeah, reality impinges, the outside world crowds in. I also like the fact that the camera is a character. The camera pursues these... And that's an old horror film trick, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
But transposed into the camera pursues people up around the rock and into the caves.
And you mentioned the soundtrack. I was very struck by the electronic soundtrack. I didn't find it invasive or incongruous at all, but I did... feel that the change in atmosphere from the book and the film versions to this, as I said, very blood and thunder melodrama was also largely occasioned by the music, which was very forceful, modern, and quite strident, really.
Yeah.
And it worked with what it was doing.
Yeah. My notes I scribbled down, it's Edwardian Lost. Which it could well be. Maybe there's a polar bear in the woods, I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to stick with it. I find it very enjoyable. Finally, she's been waiting weeks for her turn to do it. It's Sian's summer stuff.
Mm.
Let's have a listen to Sian's summer choices. Janglesome sound of a Sean Patton summer there. That was the Jesus Mary Chain with Just Like Honey from Psycho Candy, possibly the least summery record ever. It's her classic summer album, despite sounding like sheets of rain. Then the Lemon Twigs with Small Victories from their new one, The Lemon Twigs Go to School, which is so new, it's not even out yet, but it's Sean's new summer album. And then Stephen Stills with Johnny's Garden from the album Manassas, Sean's ultimate summer tune. Sean, where are the drum machines?
Now, I thought that it was a really eclectic mix until you suddenly said that, and I listened to them all three and realised it was all jangly guitar. That wasn't a conscious decision.
Why is Psycho Candy your summer album? Because it sounds like rain and headaches to me.
No, absolutely. This is not counterintuitive. It is a really summery record. If you listen to Just Like Honey and you listen to You Trip Me Up and Taste of Cindy and My Little Underground, feedback to me is like radiation from sunshine. It's really bright orange and yellow and loud. And you see, you're maybe a person who actually does go on a beach holiday. Most of my holidays as a kid were spent in Twickenham, following my mum around if she had to go to an estate to order some sweatshirts for the new thing that she'd just set up. Summer to me is pavements and it's boredom and it can be rain, it can be sun, and this just sounds of it. They sound bored, but they sound happy, they sound sad, they sound like busy, they sound lazy, they sound everything on it. But as I say, it's that idea that it's such a full sound that to me is the sun. I just can't tell you how summary that is to my brain.
Well, your synesthetic brain is your own affair.
There's also a fantastic video for You Trip Me Up where they're walking around Portugal looking really bored in leather trousers, and it's obviously a million degrees. And they have a shot of them, you know, walking down, and then suddenly it cuts to a shot of them all on the beach. And they're just lying down and Bobby Gillespie's standing up and they're doing absolutely nothing, really, really hot on a beach. That to me is summer.
In their leather trousers.
In the leather trousers, really bored as well. You have to have that studied boredom.
My mates in Athens were a part of a large Greek goth contingent for a while, and they would all go to the beautiful Dodecanese Islands in the blistering sun in August in their black leather jeans, their black leather jacket, just sit there feeling miserable.
Obviously with alabaster skin and masses of acne. That summer. It totally is summer. There you go.
Tell us about the Lemon Twigs then.
Well, the Lemon Twigs are very, very young people, brothers Brian and Michael Daddario. And this is their new album, which is sort of a musical about a monkey called Shane that goes to school. It's also got Todd Rundgren on it. Their mum, Susan, who plays the mum, Todd Rundgren plays the dad in this sort of weird conceptual musical album. And it's also got Jodie Stevens from Big Star on it. And at points sounds like Brown Sugar by the Rolling Stones. It sounds like Big Star when they do Queen of My School. It sounds like Grease. It sounds like Todd Rundgren. It sounds like nothing you could make up. The computer definitely said no to this one. It doesn't sound like anyone could have said, this is a good idea, especially not in this country. And you just think, that transports me. That is such an adventure. It's so different to anything I'm experiencing in my life, which is obviously alabaster skin and people in leather trousers. I just absolutely love it, and it's joyous, and it's totally barking mad, and it lasts for hours and hours and hours. It's just fabulous.
It's very optimistic. It's not my kind of music, but I love the happiness of it. To me, it's like if Uncut magazine decided to launch Teen Uncut, they would be in it.
Yes, they probably would. But actually, it's quite a sad story if you hear what happens to the monkey at school.
Well, no spoilers.
Absolutely. It's out in a million years' time. It's out August 25th, but it is fab.
Yes, well, there you go. Well, you can actually get that one now available as an instant grat download.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, Johnny's Garden by Stephen Stills. Yeah. This is your ultimate summer tune. Why?
It is happy, sad. Again, it has the melancholy that David Benham was talking about of summer. It talks about swifts, which are my favourite bird. When they come to England, they go very soon. They've been enjoying the sunshine. They go to Africa again. They come and it's about him.
They poo all over David's house.
They probably do, yes. Sorry about that, David. But it's about him going to rehab. It's about Stephen Stills in rehab, needing to clean out, having to do nothing, just sitting in the garden and just watching the birds and the grass grow. And it's just such a beautiful song. You can't describe it anymore. It is totally summer in a massive Pimm's cup.
Where does this come in the catalogue? When did it come out?
In the catalogue, I think it's 72, man. And I'm not really a hippie, as you can quite clearly see, but it's a really good album, Manassas. I would recommend listening to that. It's a double as well, so that lasts forever. So you can just put it on the background. It's beautiful.
I just point to Ernie Lilo. The two books you've chosen are Rise and Kill First by Ronan Bergman or Ulysses by James Joyce. Now, I'd say it's a brave person. Or maybe I'd like to have a long enough holiday to read Ulysses. A brave person to take Ulysses to the beach.
Which I have done, yeah.
You're not sitting there with Ulysses, but with like a Jackie Collins inside it, pretending to be clever.
No, Jackie Collins outside and Ulysses inside, because people call me pretentious. I am pretentious. This is fine. I've read it 3 times. It's my favourite book. When I read it and finish it, I get really upset that I'm not within the book anymore. It's one of those things I just want to start it again. It's the most fabulous, rich, glorious book about the human condition that has ever been written. It's absolutely amazing. And people just think you're a lunatic and you're pretending that you know, why would you write this? Oh, it's very difficult to understand. It's not. Just get into it. Just start. I would recommend a really long journey. So either a very long plane journey or a very long train journey, which usually when I start it, if I've got that, I know that I can get into it, get to page 300, then go. And then have some boredom time, or you've got jet lag, where you just finish it. It's about, is it 600 pages or so?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, 600, 800, depending on what edition. But I would heartily recommend it. Just go buy Ulysses. It's really cheap as well because it's a classic edition. And just discover it. It's fantastic.
Given that absolutely everything else has been adapted for Netflix twice.
There is a film of Ulysses and it's quite good. And that's an hour and a half.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, 60s film.
Who ought to be doing the extended 12-episode Netflix thing? Because I can imagine the Legion people would do quite a good job with it, actually.
Todd Haynes.
Todd Haynes.
He might do a good job. It's also about ambivalent sexuality. Mm. It's about identity. It's about everything. It's just about everything. It's amazing. I mean, I know I sound like an idiot, but I can only froth about it. And because I haven't read it for 2 years, I'm waiting for the next thing, and then I'll be really erudite.
What is Rise and Kill First by Ronan
Berger? It's about the Mossad. And it was recommended...
That's more my speed.
It was recommended to me by an Uber agent that I was on a table with at one point, who just said it's absolutely fantastic. It's like a soap opera of the Israel state-sponsored killings. It veers off in lots of different directions. It's about psychology. It's about death. It's about identity. It's about learned behaviour and innate behaviour. And he said he just couldn't recommend it enough. And as you can see, I quite like a weighty read in the summer. I think it's best to dive in there and read Grazia by November. So I'm really looking forward to it. And the paperback is out July 26th. So I was going to get that version. But it just looks incredible. And it has been praised for its massive research.
Amazing. Well, yeah. Stephen King, eat your heart out. I think that is probably the end of the show. I think you listeners have got plenty to take away there. We'll be asking for your book reports shortly. Thanks to our special guests, Anthony Teasdale and David Bennin, for coming in.
Cheers. It's been a joy.
It's been a joy. You are welcome to come in whenever you like. What pop music events are you looking forward to for the rest of the summer then? Have you got anything penciled in?
I'm looking forward to, I suppose it's after summer really, but when Nick Mason's band goes to the Roundhouse to do the early Floyd stuff, the Piper at the Gates of Dawn and Saucer Full of Secrets, I'm told that the early small concerts they did a few weeks ago in London were amazing.
Yes.
And the idea of early Floyd at the Roundhouse, I know it's not the new thing, but I'm still hugely looking forward to it, because it's one aspect of Floyd that's really been ignored and discarded over the years, and I think it really deserves that hearing.
It's Nick Mason doing his own tribute band to himself.
Basically, yes.
Yeah, well, I bet you'll be there, won't you, Teasdale?
Well, I mean, like
Floyd, early Floyd.
Yeah, I mean, without going a bit into like Liverpool 1984 and sort of sitting on the floor and smoking all sorts of strange cigarettes. No, I'm a lover of the Floyd, but I'm not a massive live music fan.
Mm.
This is, I know, heresy, but I did have an excellent live music experience the other night at a nice London hotel. God, I'm sickening. Called The Pilgrim, and there was an ace jazz trio on. And again, I know people listening are, this bloke's talking absolute rubbish.
Nice.
But it was absolutely fantastic on a sultry summer evening, listening to a guy on a muted trumpet, a guy playing slightly George Benson-y, and a lovely lady singing Pennies from Heaven.
The great lady.
And it was absolutely, and hearing that close up was absolutely great. So that's my sort of thing for live music.
So he's going to go and see early Floyd at the Roundhouse, and you're going to Pizza Express from Venice in Peril to hear some double bass jazz.
I would absolutely take that. And also, you don't have to queue for the loo.
You don't have to queue for the
lyrics. Do you know what I mean? That's keep music recorded. That's what I say.
Yeah. This, recorded music is a killing live music. Good.
Good.
Yeah. Thanks, of course, also to Sian for her infinite patience to finally get to do her summer stuff, and to our producer, Sophie Black. Don't forget, dear listener, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth, or just go on your favourite podcast platform and search for Big Mouth. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us that virtual pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. We're back again next week with more of the same. Until then, stay out of the direct sunlight.